So we were talking about clustering last time, and we were talking about the k-means algorithm. So let's just briefly recap what that is doing. And k-means, you have your data. So I'm going to run through the example really quickly, the ones that we had at the very end of last lecture. You have a set of data points, and what you want to do is you want to discover these groups or populations within this data. And the way you do this is you start out by saying, suppose I want two populations. I know that I have two clusters in this data. I just don't know where they are. I want you to find them. So you start by placing cluster centroids in random locations, right? And then for every point, you look and see whether that point is closer to the red cluster or to the yellow cluster, right? So that ends up drawing some sort of a line in your space, a line that is defined by the distance function, and we haven't talked about them yet, but I'll briefly mention them on the next slide. And everything that's to one side of the line is going to be closer to yellow, so we're going to label it yellow, and everything on the other line we're going to label as red because it's closer to the red dot. Now, so this is a clustering. It's not a really good one because I started with random locations for centroids. But what happens as you iterate things? Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take all the points that were colored yellow and compute the mean of those, all the points that were colored red, compute the mean of those, and move my centroids to the new locations. So these are going to be my new locations. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to recolor the points again. So these two points, they used to be yellow because they used to be closer to that cluster centroid, but now they're actually closer to the new red than to the new yellow, so they change colors. And you keep doing this, recoloring the points based on which cluster they fall into, and then changing the cluster means, the cluster centroids, based on what points fall into that cluster. It's an iterative procedure. You keep doing it and doing it and doing it until you come to the point where no dots change colors. And that point will happen at some moment in time. And at that point, you have converged. You have clustered the data. If you keep running, nothing will change. So all the points that are closest to red will stay closer to red. All the points that are colored yellow will stay yellow. It's a stationary point. Nothing will change. So, and even though you started with completely nonsensical cluster positions, after a few iterations, you are going to have reasonable values for cluster centroids. This is the algorithm that we've run. So basically, this is just saying in words what we did on the previous slide in a little bit more general way. So we have a set of endpoint points. We decide that we want k clusters. We randomly place the k centroids. And then we iterate these two operations. For each point, we find the nearest cluster and assign that point to that cluster. And then once all the points are reassigned, we recompute the cluster centroids. So let's look at in a little more detail at what we're doing here. So what we are assuming is that we have a distance function, a distance measure, that allows us to compute how far away a point is from the cluster. And if you are working in a numeric space, then distances come naturally. You have Euclidean distance, if nothing else. But if you're working in discrete spaces, it gets a little bit more creative. You actually have to design distance functions. And depending on which distance function you pick, you will obviously get different results. So for example, if you're trying to cluster text, you would not want to use Euclidean distance between two pieces of text. Okay. When you're recomputing the cluster centroids, that is a very simple operation. All you're doing there is you're saying, so A is a subscript that represents all the attributes in my data, and then the jth cluster, Cj, it's just a vector in that space, right? So you can think of it as Cj is an array subscripted by A. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take all the instances that were assigned to Cj in the previous step, all the instances that were colored red or colored yellow, and take a look at their values for attribute A. And I'm assuming that the values are numeric, so I can just take those things and average them out. Right? If they're not numeric, then k-means is not your best friend in this. In this sort of endeavor. Okay, the algorithm stops, as we said, when no cluster assignments change. So if you come to the point where you've done an iteration and no points changed clusters, you're done. The complexity of the algorithm is k is the number of clusters times n, n is the number of data instances times d. D is your dimensionality in this case. This is relatively fast as clustering algorithms go. We will see hierarchical clustering algorithms there on the order of m cubed. Yes?
Is it guaranteed to stop?
Yes, it is guaranteed to stop, but you're not guaranteed to like the point where it stops. So this complexity is ignoring the iterations. So in practice, you multiply it by however many iterations you will run it on. And on a realistically sized data set, you're probably not going to run it until convergence, because it's going to take its sweet time converging. So you run it for a few iterations, and after a few iterations, you have a reasonable positioning of the cluster means. All right. So a couple of things to note about k-means in general. So you can look at k-means as an optimization procedure. As any time you have an iterative algorithm, it's probably optimizing something. So what k-means is optimizing, it's optimizing the distance, the average or the aggregate distance between the points and the centroids of the clusters to which they've been assigned. Or the square distance. So this is the objective function that k-means is trying to maximize. It probably doesn't matter to you, but this is a this will come into play when we talk about when we talk a bit about EM at the end of this lecture, perhaps. So it is not globally optimal, meaning where you converge depends on where you started. So remember, you start by randomly placing centroids somewhere in space. If you place centroids in one position and next day you place them in another, you're not guaranteed to get the same clustering. So how do you know if your clustering is any good? Well, in fact, you don't really know. So what you do with k-means is you start it from random locations, you run it for a few iterations, and then you rerun it from a different starting position, right? And you can use this, the objective, which is the total distance from the centroids, to tell you if one starting location is better, results in a better clustering than another starting location, right? So if you put them in random places, run k-means until convergence, record what is the variance, what is the total distance within the clusters. And then on the second iteration with different starting points, if you get a lower total distance, that means that the second clustering is somehow better. It's somehow tighter, right? So think about what this is doing. This is saying within each cluster, how far away the points are from the middle. It doesn't consider distances between clusters. So if you got a really good clustering and in every cluster all the points are close to the mean, then this is going to be a small number. So you can use that as a guide to tell you how good your clustering is. But it is important to remember that it's not going to converge to the lowest possible variance. It's not going to give you the best possible clustering. It's going to give you a local minimum, something that is feasible from where you started. If your data set is small enough, you do have the luxury of running k-means multiple times. If your data set is large, you're probably going to run k-means once and hope for the best. So another caveat about k-means, and it's not immediately obvious from human intuition, but it seems that the way k-means operates is so there's this cloud of points, and it's going to guide the centroids to where you have the clumps of points. But you will not necessarily have the property that points that are nearby are going to end up in the same cluster. So this may seem a little bit counterintuitive, but it does actually happen. So if you look at this situation right there, so I have 4 points, 1, 2, 3, 4, and I have two cluster centroids, the red cluster centroid and the yellow cluster centroid, right? So if you looked at it with human eyes, you would say that this is a pretty bad clustering, right? So red is one cluster and yellow is another cluster. What you would like to do is you would like to place the centroids here and here and say, this is one cluster and this is another cluster, right? And you would hope that the k-means procedure can actually take you from this position to that, but it can't. So you can check, this is a stable minimum. So this is a convergence point. It is a local minimum, but it's a stable minimum. If k-means clustering gets into this position where this is one centroid and this is another centroid, it can't get out. There is a better minimum. If this just moved there and this just moved there, you'd be in a better shape, but it can't. This is a local minimum. You don't get to get out of it. Right. So, well, this is a contrived example. You might be saying this is never going to happen in practice. It will, as soon as you start working. So it will not happen when your data is nice and sort of spherical, cloudy. So if you're dealing with nicely Gaussian observations, low dimensionality, sure enough, this is unlikely to happen. If you deal with high dimensional data where there's lots of attributes and most of the values are 0, 1, or maybe 0, 1, 2, then you're in the situation where your data is going to sit at the corners of the space, right? At the corners and the edges, sort of like I'm trying to draw there. It's sort of silly drawing high dimensional data in 3D on a 2D board, but just sort of imagine this high D space where things are either 0 or 1. Your data is going to be sitting in the corners and on the edges, and situations like that will actually happen more often than you care to think about. And that's what really leads to local minima, which are unpleasant. Okay, so another issue that you want to consider, when you start k-means, we're assuming that you know how many clusters you want from the start. So how do you decide what k is? And unfortunately, there isn't a very clear answer. There is a couple of guidelines that you can follow. So the first one is to think about whether you know something about your domain, right? If you know something about your domain, then that knowledge may give you the right value of k. So for example, if I am trying to... suppose I'm dealing with digit recognition, right, where I have numbers. Each number is represented as a bitmap, and I want to see what k-means does. So how many classes would you use there? 10, right? Because there's really only 10 digits, right? And if I was clustering letters, I would use, 26 if it's an English alphabet or... So if you know something about your domain, that could give you a useful starting point for the number of clusters. If you don't know anything about your domain, it's sort of hard. It's hard to come up with something. Why is that? That's because clustering in general is difficult to evaluate. Once you have run it, unless you're dealing with low-dimensional data where you can actually plot it and see what falls where, clustering is really hard to evaluate. It's really hard to tell whether your clustering is any good or not. So how can you try to at least figure out whether it's good or not? Well, you could try to use this metric. So we talked about the k-means minimizing the total square distance. So what you could do is you could imagine running k-means for a lot of different values of k and then seeing, well, at which point do I get the smallest divergence from the centroids, right? So when I have the smallest divergence, that means that all the points are tightly clumped around the centers, and that's good. So you want to find the minimum of that thing. Unfortunately, it doesn't quite work that way. What you'll find is if you plot it, this measure of sort of cluster tightness, it'll keep getting lower and lower as the number of clusters gets higher and higher. And it's going to be lowest when you have as many clusters as you have the data points. And you can guess why, because at that point, this distance is going to be zero, right? Because every cluster sits on top of its own, every instance, every data point sits on top of its own centroid, and it has distance zero to that centroid, and so this is one big zero. And everything that has a larger number of clusters is going to be worse than that. So that's you can't just look for the minimum. So what can you do? Sometimes, in some cases, you can look for an unusual change, sort of an unusual drop in the curve. If you plot this distance as a number of clusters, it's actually not going to look like that. It might look like that on the log scale. Usually, just goes. But as you look at it on a log scale, there may be a point that looks like a natural drop-off point. So where it was sort of growing, it was decreasing in one rate, and then plump, it plumped down, and then it's decreasing at a faster rate. So that suggests that there is some intrinsic point, some intrinsic number of clusters where it suddenly got better by an unusual amount. How often that's going to happen, really? It's unclear. So there are a couple of methods in the literature that are proposed for trying to pick K automatically, trying to pick the number of clusters automatically. Specifically, if you follow Witten and Frank, they talk about using the minimum description length for picking the number of clusters. So the basic idea of minimum description length is the following. So what you try to do is instead of optimizing something like the distance, you try to treat this problem as a compression problem. So you say, I have my original data, and that data takes a certain amount of bits to store. Now, one reason I may want to cluster the data is to reduce the amount of space, right? Because what I'm hoping for is if the data is sort of tightly clustered, then maybe I can just use cluster centroids to represent the data, right? So if I need to, so imagine your friend is sitting on the other side of the world and you need to communicate every data instance to him. So maybe instead of sending every data instance, what you can do is you can send him the cluster centroid and then say, and there is 1,000 instances that fall within that cluster, right? So, but then what you will also have to do is you'll have to send him sort of the relative distances of those instances from the cluster centroid. So the idea of minimum description length is you try to quantify in bits how much space it would take to store the cluster centroids, plus how many bits you need to say which instance goes into which cluster, and then how many bits you need to encode the distance from the instance to the cluster centroid. And then you are trying to find the value k that minimizes the sum of these three. So it's sort of, if you squint at it hard enough, it looks reasonable. In practice, it's hard to apply it in practice because you get into the issues of how you encode numbers and how you encode distances and differences. And that's sort of a field in and of itself. What is the optimal way to encode a point that is, you know, a certain distance away from another point? It's just hard to do. So it's a nice idea. In practice, you shouldn't count on that giving you anything reasonable. It's a little bit better. So when we talk about the mixture models, an extension of minimum description length is you can sort of make it. It makes a little bit more sense because you're talking about information theoretic units all the way through. But with clustering, when you're minimizing the distance, it's just hard to make it work. By the way, I didn't say the basic idea of MDL is you're looking for a set of cluster centroids that are as close to the data as possible, and you want as few of them as possible as well, right? So that the intuition there is Occam's razor. So if you have two different clusterings that explain the data, you look for a simpler clustering. And a simpler clustering is usually the one that has fewer clusters in it, right? So for example, a clustering that has n cluster centroids, it minimizes the distance, but it's not a very useful clustering at all. It's not very simple. Okay, so finally, another way to pick the right number of clusters is to see if, for a given k, to see how useful it is in something that you may be trying to do. So you are probably doing clustering for some reason. There are multiple reasons to do clustering. Maybe you're just trying to analyze the data, but maybe you're using clustering to represent the data for a follow-up step to do something else with your data. So in that case, if you're not going to stop with a set of clusters, if you're going to take your clusters and use them for something else, maybe for classification, maybe for predicting something, then you do have an objective that you can take advantage of. You can cluster with different values of k, and then you can just see which value of k works best for classification or prediction or whatever it is that you want to do with your clusters. So as soon as you don't stop with the clustering, it becomes easier to pick the optimal value of k. So let's look at an example of where you are actually using k-means clustering for something. And this is a real example for a while. A lot of the approaches to recognizing objects in the image used this representation. So it's actually a real example. So the task that we're trying to do here is image annotation, image representation. So the idea is you have a bitmap, and what you want to do is you want to slap some labels on that bitmap automatically, or perhaps classify it. So whether that photograph contains a particular animal. So does it have a tiger? Does it have water? Does it have grass? Does it have sun? Does it have trees? So it's the tagging task. And what we're thinking about is not about how to classify, not about how to predict whether it contains a tiger, but how to represent the image. You know, what is the set of attributes that you want to use for this? So once you have a set of attributes, you already know lots of classifiers that you can plug this into, right? SVMs or logistic regression. But what do you stick into an SVM? If you take a bitmap and just stick the pixels into an SVM, it's not going to work. I hope that's clear. So what you want to do is you want to somehow go from this, which is very high dimensional. You're talking about maybe thousands by thousands of pixels and maybe hundreds to thousands of colors at each pixel. You want to go from that to something a little more manageable. And a typical approach that's been used for a while is instead of trying to do sort of deep vision, you do fairly shallow processing and then stick it into a powerful classifier. So shallow processing might look something like that. You take this image, we're going to slice it up into various regions. By the way, why are we doing regions? We're doing regions because then we're going to compute a set of features from each region, and then we're going to jumble up the order because we don't know where the objects are going to be in the image. So we're going to treat each region sort of independently. You take each one of those regions, then you compute some sort of visual descriptor features from it. So perhaps you take this region and say, what is the average color in there? And so this is primarily green. What is the average texture in there? So you run a couple of filters. You see, does it have vertical stripes? Does it have horizontal stripes? Does it have dots, points, things like that? So crude visual characteristics. And then ultimately what you'd like to do is you'd like to take this feature vector and say, this is a region with a feature vector that looks like grass. Right? So if you did that, then you would have a pretty good representation for an image, right? You would say, this is grass, this is grass, this is grass, this is sky, this is water. So that would be great, except you can't really do that without human involvement, so on. A human would have to look at this and say that this is grass. So what if we don't have a human to look at every image that we want to classify? Well, what we could settle for is say we can't get grass, but let's see what happens if we replace grass with a cluster number, right? So this may seem a little confusing, but let's look at an example of the way this works. So suppose I have a big collection of images, and for every one of those images, I sliced it up into regions, and for each one of those little regions, each one of those little blots, I compute the visual features. So I compute the colors, the textures, maybe the shapes, things like that. So now each one of these blots in each image, and I'm not showing all of them, I'm just showing a couple, is represented by colors and textures, the lines, right? So what I can do is I can take them and start clustering them. So hopefully, if things go right, what will happen is every region that has sort of bluish hue and doesn't have many lines will get clustered in one area, right? In one k-means centroid. So this patch looks like this patch, looks like this patch, looks like that patch, looks like that page. They all have similar color distributions and they don't have much texture, right? So hopefully they're similar enough to where a k-mean centroid will sort of drift on top of them. And then you do it with every other patch in every other image. So greenish patches hopefully will cluster together because they look a lot alike, because they're similar to each other. And then maybe these stripy orangey black patches will also get clustered together. And you're not hoping for perfect clustering. So it'll make lots of mistakes. For example, this is a bluish region, this is a bluish region, but this was water and this was sky. That's okay. It's a bluish region, right? Same thing here. This is a tiger patch, and this is actually a coral patch, which doesn't have anything to do with tigers, but that's okay. All you're doing is cluster C14, that's just all the patches that have orange and black and are kind of stripy. Good enough. Okay? So you do that with a data set. You create a set of cluster patches. And then when the new image comes in, what you can do is you can slice it up and see which clusters do the patches fall into. So if this is an image that I've never seen before, I can already say, well, it's got some of these C79 patches, which are bluish and don't have much texture in them. It's got some of these C27 patches, which are greenish and have vertical texture. And it's got a few of these C14 patches, which are sort of stripy and orangey and black. Right? So that's what k-means allows you to do. Now, once I've done that, what I can do is I can use the cluster numbers, the cluster memberships, to redescribe the image in terms of something that looks a lot like a bag of words, which is, of course, something that we already know how to work with, right? So what would it look like? Take an image like that. All of those bluish regions, they fall into cluster C79. All of the greenish regions fall into C27. All of the stripy regions fall into C14. And now what you can do is you can take these cluster numbers and use them to represent the image. So you would take this picture, this bitmap, and instead of representing it with pixels and colors, you would just represent it by the counts. How many times did I see different cluster numbers in that image? So what does it mean, cluster numbers? It has four regions that look stripy and orange, right? So I would have four counts of C14 in there, and seven counts of C27, because it has seven regions which would fall into cluster C27 if you do k-means. Okay, so what does this let you do? This allows you to take a bitmap, which is a very high dimensional structure, lots of variation. It's very hard. You can't just take a bitmap and stick it into a classifier. By running k-means, you can drop it into a completely different set of dimensions defined by your clusters. And now the image is described by a short bag of what are word-like units, right? So again, if you had a human in the loop, you would say that C14 is a tiger patch and C27 is a grass patch, but we don't have those labels. But for learning, it doesn't actually matter that we don't have those labels. That cluster number represents a lot of similar patches. So you can stick it into a classifier and then see how well it works. So this has actually been used for a while in methods that try to auto tag images. All right. So we finished k-means clustering. Let's just, if we try to fit it into this general structure that we have, the task is you're trying to identify populations within the data. You're assuming that you know how many populations there are and you're trying to identify them. The model structure in this case is you have k centroid vectors. You initialize them randomly and then they sort of drift around the space until they found their group of points. Each one of them is a d-dimensional vector. The score function that you're trying to optimize is the average squared distance from the centroid to the data point. And then the search method is just iterative reassignment of points to to clusters. So that's it's fitting in the structure. To summarize the method, so what this lets you do is if you know how many clusters you have, this can discover the clusters for you. It's a fast method. It's an iterative method. It doesn't converge to a global maximum. To a global minimum. So in practice, if your data set is small enough, you would want to run it multiple times. And we talked about one example of where k-means is used. So it's a common example, k-means. So images is just one case. You can use k-means on any sort of data if you are looking to reduce the dimensionality of the data. So go from something very high dimensional like pixels to something much more compact like a bag of labels, right? So you can use it. You can use it with lots of different data sets. All right. So that's all for k-means. We're going to switch to talking about mixture models now. While I'm switching, if there's any questions on k-means, please ask.
Okay. How effective is this technique to actually classify or tag images? Is it commercially used?
Commercially used. So this is not the technique for classifying or tagging. This is a representation. So you take this. After that, you still need a classifier, something that takes those images. And so the final accuracy will depend on the classifier. So what you can ask is this the best you can do? No.
Okay.
So it's reasonably good, and it's also fast because it condenses the image to a very small representation. That's the main attraction of it. So it's because, you know, just think about the transformation. You started with 1 million pixels. Each pixel has 1,000 values. Here, you're mapping to a set of maybe 20 cluster labels. That's much more compact. There's
both.
So k-means generally falls into there's probabilistic methods that at some level resemble k-means a lot. They're mixture models at heart. They also sort of implicitly compress the data. As far as I'm aware, the best techniques out there are kernel-based, where there is no dimensionality reduction at all going on. So they, all of these techniques, they try to address sparseness. Clustering is one way to address sparseness, but you can also address sparseness through smoothness in the space. So, you know, saying that nearby regions in space should have the same labels. As far as I know, those are the best performing at the moment.
So the other techniques that say rather than having a fixed size region, that you'll actually allow the region to expand depending on what's in the image. Like you could take all of the orange pixels together and say that's going to be one image, and then I'll get, and I'll have some kind of feature vector cluster level based on that. That's another idea.
All right, so now we'll talk about mixture models we'll see. Maybe we'll get to the email algorithm. All right. So if you're following the book, the relevant section is 6.6 in Witten and Frank. So we talked. Well, actually, I'm not gonna go through that. We just covered all that. Mixture models. There are many different ways to talk about mixture models, and one simple connection to what we've already seen is to look at the nature of boundaries that mixture models produce in relation to k-means clustering. So we just talked about k-means. K-means is it's a hard boundary technique, meaning if I have two centroids, I draw a line between two centroids, and if a point falls on one side of the line, it goes into one cluster but doesn't go into another. And it doesn't actually matter how close the point gets to the boundary. So if you imagine, if this is one cluster centroid, if this is another cluster centroid, if this is the line that's sort of equal distance from the two centroids, a point that is right here, it would fall into this cluster and wouldn't fall into this cluster, right? Even though it's very close to the line. So k-means always makes a hard decision. This point goes there, or this point goes there. Okay? The idea, one way to think about mixture models is to make this boundary soft and fuzzy, to say that this point, it's closer to this centroid, but it's reasonably close to this one also. So perhaps, instead of saying that if this was cluster A and this was cluster B, instead of saying that this point belongs to A, what are we going to do instead is we're going to say, well, this point most likely belongs to A, but it also is pretty close to B. And maybe it's, you know, 51% in A and 49% in B. That's the basic idea of all soft clustering methods, and mixture models are one example of a soft clustering technique. So you can also talk about mixture models in probabilistic terms. So you can describe them as in terms of generative models, where you have a set of probability distributions, and your data is generated or sampled from these probability distributions. And usually the way you describe it is sampling is stochastic in the way that you have a, you flip a k-faced coin, and depending which way it lands, you sample from one or the other of the probabilistic distributions that you have in your data. So we're going to go through an example where we, a very simple example. We're going to look at mixture models in one dimension with Gaussian data and numeric data, but it's not too hard to generalize from that to the general case. So let's just dive straight into an example. So if you think back to the beginning lectures in this course, we talked about estimating a Gaussian, right? So if I give you a set of points and ask you to fit a Gaussian to it, you know how to do that, right? You know that you have to compute the mean of the Gaussian, you have to compute the covariance matrix if you're in multiple dimensions, or if you're in 1D, all you have to do is just compute the variance, and that gives you this bell shape that sits on top of the points. And if I told you that there is not one Gaussian but two Gaussians, you will say, fine, just tell me. So tell me which points correspond to which class, and I will fit two Gaussians for you, right? So that's what we've done in classification. If I tell you that there are two classes, it's very easy to fit a Gaussian to each one of the classes. So if I were sort of in that situation, I have a set of points, one-dimensional. If I tell you that there is two Gaussians, and these are the points that came from the blue Gaussian, and yellow are the points that came from the yellow Gaussian, then you know how to fit them, right? So you compute the mean of the blue points, which is just the average of their numeric values. You compute the variance, and that defines a Gaussian for the yellow points. And then you do the same thing, for the blue points, and then you do the same thing for the yellow points. So voila, you've got your Gaussians. So that's nice and easy. But what if I didn't tell you what the colors were initially? So what if I had a set of gray points and I didn't know which one of them were blue and which one of them were yellow, right? So that's sort of the situation that you run into when you're doing unsupervised learning, right? Supervised, you have training examples. You know, you have examples of blue and examples of yellow. Unsupervised, you have a bunch of data, and you suspect that it comes from a set of classes, but you just don't know what the classes are, and nobody's going to tell you the labels. You may know how many, but you might not know anything beyond that. Okay, so we can't really do anything in there. But so now, suppose that you were sort of in the flip side of that situation. If you don't know the labels, if you don't know which points are yellow and which points are blue. But suppose somebody comes along and tells you the mean and the variance of the Gaussian, right? Well, now you're in business, because now you could actually go ahead and compute the points, right? You can figure out what color the points are. If somebody tells you that this is the mean of the blue Gaussian and that's the variance, and this is the mean of the yellow Gaussian and that's the variance, then you can compute the most probable color for each point. So you would say, how would you do that? Well, you just use Bayes' rule. So look at how probable each point is under the blue Gaussian, divided by how, you know, by how probable the point is sort of on aggregate under all the Gaussians, right? And of course, you can compute this probability of xi given b, the probability of the point under the blue Gaussian, that's the way you compute it. So it's very straightforward. If somebody told you what the means are, you would just go in and say these are certainly blue and those are certainly yellow. So you have an interesting situation. If somebody told you what the means and variances are, you could put colors on instances. I'm sorry? Well, yeah, I'm sort of assuming somebody tells you priors as well. So if somebody told you the parameters, if somebody told you how many, what the mean and the variance and the prior, then you could put the colors on the points. But you don't know the parameters, right? Now, if somebody told you what the colors were, you could figure out the parameters, because we know how to estimate a Gaussian if somebody tells us what the colors are. But we don't have the colors, so it's a chicken and egg scenario. We either need the colors, and then we can get the parameters, the mean and the variance. Or if we have the mean and the variance, we can figure out what the colors are. So how do you go about solving that? And the solution is, so in machine learning, and actually in all of statistics, chicken and egg problems are good because we have iterative methods for solving them. So the basic idea is you start with some really bad estimates of parameters, and they give you some estimate of the colors. It's very, very bad estimate of the colors, but then you take those and you use those to compute the parameters of the Gaussians again, and you just keep going around in circles. And what you hope for is with time this thing will improve and give you reasonable assignments of colors to points and reasonable parameter estimates. So the procedure for doing it in that way is called the expectation maximization algorithm, and we're going to go through a very simple example of how EM works on one-dimensional data. So the example is, we're going to do basically what I said on the previous slide. We're going to do 1D example. We're going to look at two Gaussians. We're going to start by placing two Gaussians at the random point, at the random positions in our space. So what does it mean, random positions? That means we have to pick a mean and the variance for one Gaussian, a mean and the variance for another Gaussian, and we're going to start with random positions for them. And then what we're going to do is, for each point, we're going to see, does it look more like one of the Gaussians or the other? And that decision, does it look more like one or the other, we're not actually going to make a hard decision like we did in k-means. We're going to make a soft decision. We're going to keep the probability that the point belongs to one Gaussian versus the other. And then we're going to use those probabilities to re-estimate the parameters, the mean and the variance of each Gaussian. And then we're going to iterate for a number of steps. So let's just go through an example of how this works. So suppose that this is our data. It's one-dimensional, just a set of points. And we don't have any colors for it, right? Because if we did, we'd be done. So we suspect that this comes from two distributions. We suspect that there's two Gaussians describing it. So what we do is we start by putting those Gaussians in some random location, and I'm putting them at a very odd location. But this could happen randomly. This is actually one of the worst positions that you could pick. What can we do now? We've got the two Gaussians, so what we can do is we can figure out for each point, is it more likely to be yellow or is it more likely to be blue? And the way you do that is you just take the x position of each point and plug it into the Gaussian equation, and out comes the probability. Well, the density really, but we're going to pretend they're probabilities for now. So if you this is the probability of the point coming out of the Gaussian, but we also have Bayes' rule that allows us to compute the posterior probability of it being blue given the value, right? So we what I'm assuming here is we started with some initial values for the Gaussian, so we know the means, we know the variances. I'm also assuming that we know the priors. Perhaps we just set them uniformly. So what does it do? So for each point, we're going to compute the posterior probability that it falls, that it came from the blue Gaussian, right? And so we do it using just the Bayes' rule. If we compute that, and we plot it, so this dotted blue line, that the posterior probability should look something like that. Not quite like that, but that's sort of the general shape. So the further the points are to the right, the more likely they are to come from the blue Gaussian, and sort of the further they are to the left, the more likely they are to be yellow. So now if I do that, that gives me some coloring of the points. So the points that are all the way out here, I'm pretty sure that they came from the blue Gaussian rather than the yellow one. The point over there, I'm sort of not sure. It's more yellowish because it's closer to the yellow mean, and this one is probably bluish, right? So I'm assigning colors to points in the same way that I did with k-means, only now they're not solid colors. I'm getting shades between yellow and blue. So that's this fractional belonging, that's the fuzzy boundary thing, right? So the point falls both into the yellow and the blue with varying weights. So now once I've got the colors, I can go ahead and update my Gaussians. So what does it do? How do I do that? This is the colors. This is the colors of the points that I get from the previous step. And now what I need to do is, if these were solidly colored, everything would be simple. I would just average out all the blue ones and get the blue mean and the blue variance, average out all the yellow ones and get the yellow mean and the yellow variance. But the colors aren't solid. So what I do is I have to update the mean and the variance in terms of these sort of fuzzy colors. And the way I do that is, so let's look at the mean and the variance for the blue. What I'm doing is I'm adding up the x values for all the instances in the data, but I'm putting a weight on every instance. And that weight is the probability that that point came from the blue, right? So let's think about it another way. So imagine, think back to the example where, to the k-means example, where the colors were solid. So if these were solid blue, and these were solid yellow, then BI, the weight, it would be 1 for the blue points and 0 for the yellow points. So when I'm computing the sum, it would include only the blue points because the yellow ones would be zeroed out.